Good morning. Today, the Honolulu City Council Budget Committee again considers bills to lower the tax burden for low-income homeowners, a pilot program to repurpose DOE facilities on city land, and to create a database for transportation companies like Uber. The bills all have Ann Kobayashi's name on them, and we'll talk with her later this hour. A delegation from India is at the UH Law School this week. It's part of a growing partnership between that school and the Jindal School of Law. We'll talk with its founding dean, C. Raj Kumar. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. It's a Maui homecoming for dancers in the Adaptations Dance Theater's upcoming Bring It Home dance concert. We'll talk with choreographer Amelia Couture.
For Wednesday, June 15th, that's The Conversation. Next, the news. Good morning and welcome to a Wednesday on The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Some interesting comparisons to be made between Hawaii and India.
This is true, and we're going to talk about some of those this morning in a way that maybe you don't stop to think about a whole lot. But, you know, college and grad students often fill their summers with internships to make sense of what they learn in class with some real-world experience. For a handful of law students from India, their summer is being spent in Hawaii, working as externs for justices of the Hawaii Supreme Court. It's one program of a growing partnership between India and Hawaii for the Jindal Global Law School and UH. A delegation from the school is in Honolulu to discuss environmental court, climate change, and the environmental rule of law in India and Hawaii at the UH Law School Symposium. Founding dean of Jindal Global Law School and the founding vice chancellor, which we would know as the president of Jindal University, is Professor C. Raj Kumar, who joins us now in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
We talked a lot about the growing partnership between India and UH, or Jindal Law School and UH, but how this partnership was started kind of goes back to the whole issue of why people travel and why people have greater conversations. In brief, tell us how this began.
A few years ago, I was here with my family vacationing in Hawaii, and at that time, I got to meet with Justice Michael Wilson, who was at that time a judge of the circuit court, and we began talking about possibilities of doing things together. And then later, over the last several years, Dean Avi Soifer, as well as Denise, and also a couple of judges from the Supreme Court of Hawaii visited India. That began an evolutionary relationship which involved the National Green Tribunal in India, the Supreme Court of India, and of course the Jindal Global Law School. The most important part of this partnership is what you said about the fact that the Indian externs and students are coming here and pursuing this externship program with the Supreme Court of Hawaii. But it also involves the possibility of bringing together people who are deeply committed to the environment, the rule of law, as well as shared understanding of some of the most fundamental human values towards creating opportunities for relationships.
That's the global context of all this. It's simply not a partnership between Hawaii and India, but it's networking a lot of organizations and a lot of schools together. You have several partnerships, not just with Hawaii's UH, but going to Cornell, with Harvard, with other universities that you've also been working with. But the nexus for Hawaii very clearly is the work on the environment, from which Hawaii has been drawing a great deal of expertise from India. What specifically?
That is very true, because as a global university, which has been part of our endeavor from the very beginning and since its founding, to build substantive collaborations with universities around the world, we have a very strong partnership with the leading universities in the United States. And the vision of these partnerships is to provide opportunities for students to have shared experiences in both institutions, but also for faculty to pursue research and knowledge creation, which is fundamental to the very existence of universities. as far as the universe, the relationship with Hawaii is concerned, you're absolutely right that we began the partnership with a joint conference between the University of Hawaii Law School as well as Jindal Global Law School, in which the dean and the vice dean of Hawaii were at our law school. But it has also now become much broader than the two law schools. As I mentioned early on, Hawaii has particularly been inspired by the Indian efforts to create institutional mechanisms for protecting the environment. The National Green Tribunal in India is a unique institution in the world in which a formal institutional legislative mechanism comprising of judges as well as environmental experts are involved in protecting the environment through an adjudicatory process, which is different from what the courts would do. And of course, Hawaii has played a leadership role in establishing these environmental courts. It's the second second state in the whole of the United States to do what it has done. But this process is also becoming much broader. Given the leadership role that Hawaii has played, it has also received huge attention from the global community because issues relating to environment and climate change are no longer confined to a single nation, a single state. And that's exactly what is taking place in Hawaii this week. There is a judicial colloquium that is taking place today with the Chief Justice of India, a judge of the Supreme Court of India, and also the chairperson of the National Green Tribunal from India, having a conversation with all the five judges of the Supreme Court of Hawaii. This is followed by a conference tomorrow organized by the University of Hawaii School of Law as well as Jindal Global Law School, in which many other people in the community as well as academics and judges and lawyers are going to have this conversation.
At the level at which we are right now with the environmental court, and this is a newer thing for us, not new, but a newer thing. Where do you think Hawaii needs to go next?
I think the most important thing, the establishment of the environmental court gives us, it's a signaling effect. It recognizes that environment is an important aspect of public policy and governance, which states ought to take it seriously. The second aspect of the environmental court is the fact that increasingly rule of law and adherence to the rule of law is going to be the central aspect of public policy in relation to environment. And the third, and in many ways a very important aspect of this, is that adjudicatory processes through environmental courts creates an opportunity for both creating transparency and accountability in relation to environment. And I think what is taking place now is this process of shared understanding of what other countries around the world are doing, what kind of experiences of both legal and institutional mechanisms are shaping the policies relating to environment, including a part which India has played a role in relation to Hawaii, is the training and capacity building aspects of some of the judges at the lower courts in relation to environmental adjudicatory process. I also think that these experiences have now culminated to a global conversation in which later this year the International Union of Conservation of Nature is actually going to be in Hawaii, which is an extraordinary tribute to the leadership and institution building initiative that is prevailing in Hawaii as a reflection of its larger commitment to environment for the cause of humanity.
When you talk about that larger commitment, though, you're also talking about people who have to carry it forward, including a lot of lawyers. We've seen enrollment in law schools decrease in recent times. Certainly the cost has been increasing, putting both of those things together, not just in the United States, but globally. What is it that you think we need to take this conversation further in seeing how we create those opportunities for people who would be lawyers and would be involved in environmental issues, as we've just been talking about, or other issues that have global import?
Well, as you know, in this country, but also around the world, issues relating to student debt is a very significant challenge. The contemporary challenges of enrollments in law schools is shaped not because of the fact that law school education is less important or less prominent, at least from the standpoint of the prestige and opportunities that come with it. It really is about the kind of student debt and access to education that is affecting. I must say that the University of Hawaii Law School is playing a leadership role. It has always maintained a sense of commitment to social justice and accessibility to high-quality education. A large number of students within the University of Hawaii are coming from backgrounds who may not be able to afford education, and this school in particular has kept that as a part of its commitment. This may not be the case with many other law schools in Hawaii, in the U.S., but I have to say that education is one of the most democratizing aspects of anybody's aspiration. And so we cannot ignore the importance of education, although we should create opportunities to provide access, and that's where scholarships and fellowships and studentships need to play a much larger role. We need to think about the kind of curriculum and course structure which enables students to pursue the kind of careers as they graduate out of law schools. These are all part of the conversation that is taking place, not just in Hawaii and in the United States, but also around the world.
Bringing down the cost of education, though, seems to be where all of this lies.
Well,
and we've seen a lot of that in the current presidential campaign cycle.
Very true. And I think there have been conversations about making the college education free. Beyond the politics of it, it is important for us to recognize that public policy requires speaking truth to power. And many a time, that may not happen during the electoral process. I think when the dust settles after the elections, we might be able to see a more sort of balanced approach to looking at these issues. You mentioned about, the access to education. I do believe that people should see value for educational processes. And on the one hand, but also I think we need to create better opportunities for people to access good quality education. And here I must say that the United States, at least for the last 100 years, has played a leadership role around the world. Today universities around the world, and not now, but for the last 100 years, have been looking up to the U.S. higher education and how it has played a leadership role in inspiring institutional creations around the world. And the strength of United States is actually the kind of inspiration it has offered to universities around the world, but also the educational possibilities it has provided to people around the world. I, for one, had the privilege to study at Harvard Law School, got a fellowship here, and like me, many of my friends and colleagues from around the world had the privilege to come and study in the U.S. This privilege and this aspect of education being a democratizing force is something which U.S. has to build on. But we need to address the issue of debt. And one of the ways by which we can address debt is to see how we can reduce the cost of education that obviously is formidable now.
Professor Kumara, I wish we had more time to talk, but perhaps we will in future while you're here with your family.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here. Rhodes Scholar and Professor C. Raj Kumar is the founding vice chancellor, or what we would know as the president, of O.P. Jindal Global University in the National Capital Region of Delhi, India. He's also the founding dean of Jindal Global Law School and holds degrees from the University of Delhi, Oxford University, Harvard Law School, and the University of Hong Kong. He's in Honolulu to participate in the 2016 India-Hawaii Law Symposium and continue the ongoing partnership between UH and Jindal Global Law School. Tomorrow, there's a symposium at UH Law School. It's open to all at no cost.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's 8:18 and coming up, looking at the Hawaii Meth Project. But first, your quiz.
Mau, In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a lifelong public servant who was part of the generation of Hawaii politicians who created the state's constitution. His career in public life was fostered at the University of Hawaii, where he served as president of the Associated Students in 1944 and 45. That led him to the 1950 Hawaii State Constitutional Convention, a gathering that drafted the state laws for Hawaii that would go into effect when statehood came in 1959. He was elected to the territorial legislature in 1954 as part of the celebrated Democratic Revolution of that year. Others who were swept into office included Dan Inouye, George Ariyoshi, and Spark Matsunaga. The men we're looking for today served in the Hawaii Territorial Senate from 1955 to 59, and then in the Hawaii State Senate from 1959 to 1969. During his tenure, he was frequently at odds with John A. Burns, Hawaii's first governor after statehood. His career as an officer holder peaked when he became the fifth lieutenant governor of Hawaii from 1974 to 78 in the first elected administration of Governor George Ariyoshi. This morning, we'd like you to name him. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first right answer will be rewarded with an HPR T-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Kurt Tsui from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. I love the way that blue dress hangs over your body.
Hawaii Public Radio has the largest newsroom of any radio station in Hawaii. We produce programs that make up more than a quarter of what's on our air, and we provide two streams that cover all eight of our state's major islands. These are just some of the reasons these Hawaii residents gave to their public radio station. Susan Sugiyama of Honolulu, Kathleen DePalma of Kula, and Richard Williams of Volcano. Mahalo to all our members who fill us with pride of place every day. Connect with us on Facebook.
Building a life after meth usually isn't a public event unless someone decides it could be in the public interest. That was a decision of Jordiana DaCosta, the executive director of the Hawaii Meth Project. As part of our collaboration with Civil Beats on the podcast Hawaii's New Ice Age, Chad Blair joins us now with a reality check about DaCosta and how she reclaimed her life. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
We've had Jordiana DaCosta on the program before to talk specifically about the Meth Project, but in looking at her own life, you took a pretty deep dive into what it meant for her in being able to just have a life.
It's quite a story, and as you mentioned, it's part of this podcast and radio series that concludes today, and I hope folks will check it out on the dangers, the horrible reality of people facing crystal methamphetamine. You'd think that finally we'd be getting over this crisis, but no, that is not the case. The story today is by Eric Pape, and it's quite moving. It's really a cautionary tale of how to survive crystal meth and how important it is, how critical, really central, to have family involved to help you get over this crisis.
That old tenet about someone really needs to hit rock bottom before they're able to come back up again leads to the other question, well, what's bottom? How do you know when you're there, when you go searching for that bottom?
Right.
What was it for Jordiana DaCosta?
You know, it's interesting that there was no one single rock bottom moment. There were a series, and I'll just go over a couple of them. Jordiana DaCosta's problem started in high school, 17 years old. She's a mother, and she's exposed to crystal methamphetamine, right? And then she later goes on to heroin. Pretty soon, she's forging her mom's checks. She's stealing the family VCR to sell it for cash because she's in a constant need for cash for more drugs. Then she gets pregnant with her second child, has postpartum depression. That only leads her to more drugs. Finally, she's living in a van with her boyfriend, and that's when she called mom. That's when she called Mahalani Cipher and said, "Can you raise the kids?" "Well, on one condition," said mom, "you have got to get clean." And that is the real challenge that she then undertook. I won't give away the entire story, except to say that there is a good ending that comes, but really quite sobering.
Clearly, we know there's a good ending because she's the executive director of the Hawaii
right.
Meth Project, and she's talked in fits and spurts about this. But to actually hear how someone who we may know only in the context of that project
right.
talk about the really nitty-gritty details of her life, as you say, is quite moving. And thanks very much for bringing us that story today.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Chad Blair joins us daily with a reality check, the four-part podcast with stories by Hawaii Public Radio and Civil Beat are available on both websites. That would be civilbeat.org and hawaiipublicradio.org.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, we're headed for outer space, yeah?
It seems like every time we talk, I'm ready to launch off that rocket pad and head into space.
Well, we need you for just a couple minutes more, Bert.
Okay, well, I'll put my my rocket helmet down for a minute and,
okay.
and share with you the fact that as sort of pie in the sky that might sound, there has been some work, and this work has been going on for probably the last more than 10, 15 years to mm-hmm. really look at the possibility of growing an aerospace company here in Hawaii, or aerospace industry. Now, there's elements of aerospace, you know, here.
Sure.
There's, you know, the space industries. There's the rocket launch capability over at Pacific Missile Range.
Mm-hmm.
There's... some of the satellite tracking stuff over on Maui. There's on the Big Island. You know, there's a lot of the Mars and lunar analog systems, like high seas on the Big Island.
Yeah.
There also was a point in time when they were looking at a launching pad on the southern tip in Kau. So what we're trying to explore is where are we with this whole aerospace industry discussion, and when we had. Glenn Wakai, Senator Glenn Wakai, on mm-hmm. At the beginning of the session, and he was pretty bullish on aerospace. Now, we are trading him for Senator Will Esparro, so Will Esparro is going to come on, and we'll also have Pat Sullivan from OceanNet, and we'll have also a couple people calling in, Don Straney from UH Hilo and Jim Cristofulli, who's with DBIT. And we'll try to get a sense as to where are we with aerospace and what's it going to take to actually get something more substantive, I guess, if in terms of maybe money toward this kind of an industry.
Well, there's certainly some pieces of the puzzle already in place, yeah, Bert?
Well, yeah, there's pieces of it. And you know, surprisingly, Hank Rogers has been a big player in just helping fund the high seas project that's on the Big Island, which is the kind of the Mars analog, where you have folks in there in the habitat for like a year. So
yeah,
you know, that's a public-private partnership.
Why go to Mars when you can go to the Big Island? Right?
Sign me up.
Thanks a lot, Bert.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m.
Good morning. It's now 8:28, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. If you'd like to be in touch, our talk back line is available 24/7 at 808-792-8217. We're also on Twitter at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR, and you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, we're going to take a look at a few of the bills coming up at the Honolulu City Council today and later home to Maui for a dance concert and a world premiere.
Oi, to the bay. This is Sandy Tsukiyama, host of Brazilian Experience. To celebrate Father's Day this week, I'll be bringing you 2 hours of musical fathers and their children, like the three generations of Jobims and the Caimis. That's Saturday afternoon from 4 to 6 on Brazilian Experience.
Aloha, I'm Shauna Tonkin from the Pacific Aviation Museum, Pearl Harbor. You're tuned to HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
This morning, the Honolulu City Council Budget Committee again takes up several bills that could have some high-profile consequences. Bills 34, 35, and 36 all have Ann Kobayashi's name on them. We called her earlier this morning to get a reminder of what the bills would do, and we started with Bill 34 to create a pilot program to repurpose public school lands leased from the city.
Yes, where schools and school offices are on land that's owned by the city. It's leased to the DOE. And some of those small schools, some of the offices want to change over and become maybe offices downstairs and workforce housing upstairs in the upper floors, which I thought was a great idea. It's kind of a win-win. And then the revenue from the rental of those workforce housing would go back to the DOE for their programs. Then that's why I'm introducing the legislation to allow this to happen so that the city will continue to lease to DOE.
Would there be any problems with zoning if you're talking about people living in the upper levels and having the lower levels still remain offices?
Mm-hmm. The one we're looking at is on Yonge Street, kind of near Linacona Art Center. I believe it's already zoned, mixed zoning. If not, certainly that area is already developed with housing and businesses.
If the pilot program goes forward, what would be the total amount of impact that you would see with other parcels of land that are leased to the DOE that might be in the same circumstance?
Yeah, well, there are three that they're looking at. There are three that do not have a large impact because they're not large parcels of land. And to put up workforce housing is really needed. And it's really a win-win because the revenue goes back to the DOE for their programs.
Any sense of how many people would be able to be housed in all three properties?
Well, this one on Yonge Street, I believe it was a little over 100 because there are only about 80 apartments.
So in terms of the pilot program, the three properties that you're looking at, but if the pilot is successful, how many other properties do you see that might be developed in the same way?
Yeah, the DOE is the one who makes that selection because they decide which offices can be closed or removed for a while. I don't know if there are any, like, schools. You know, there is that large school up in Kaimuki that has been closed, but it's a lot of DOE offices are there. We thought that might be a nice place for senior housing. However, the DOE does not want to do it at this time. So they are the ones who make the selection because they decide which properties could be developed.
Switching gears here for a second, looking at another bill that you introduced, this one for real property tax credits for low-income homeowners.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at the stipulation of all of those and bringing it down from 4% to 3% of the homeowner's income in terms of what it might exceed in the tax revenue.
Mm-hmm.
How many people do you expect that this might affect if, in fact, this goes forward?
Well, you see, it's a program that's in effect right now. Anyone who makes 60% or less pays either 4% of their income for property tax or the property tax, whichever is lower, because 4% of your income, if you're only making $20,000, that's only $800. So you can pay $800 and your property tax may be $2,000, but your household has to make $60,000 or less.
By bringing it down to 3%, though,
bringing it down to 3%.
How many more people would be embraced by that?
Yeah, we're not sure, but it's not a huge amount. But we're helping those in the lowest income bracket. So we don't want people to lose their property. We don't want people to become homeless because they can't afford to pay their property tax. You know, there's some people who live in Kahala who live there for, you know, over 50 years, and the assessments keep going up, and they can't afford to pay the property tax. So if they make less than $60,000 a year, then they can be in this program.
Finally, I want to ask you about the bill for private transportation services and drivers. This battle with Uber and
Uber, Lyft, and the taxi companies. And we've been trying to find a level playing field because it's good to have, you know, the more businesses we have here, the better. And we're not trying to drive anyone out of business, including having the stiff competition against taxis. So we're trying to level the playing field and think we can make this work, have a central database where all the drivers and vehicles would have to be registered. It doesn't matter how your company is operated, as long as all the drivers and vehicles are registered, because the city, you know, looks out for the safety and protection of riders. So we think having all the drivers in a central database will make it safer for our customers. Bill 36 only is for a central database for public transportation drivers and vehicles.
So they're not necessarily going to have to register in this database, because it seems like it's going to be asking people for a lot of information about them that maybe some drivers would be uncomfortable having in a database.
Right. So it'll be like Uber would be listed as Uber, and then Uber would be responsible and liable for all the certification of their drivers. And the certification is following the national and state laws, the criminal background check. The state recently passed an insurance program for taxis and public transportation companies. So it's whatever's the law. That's what we're saying the drivers should follow, tax clearance, and the companies themselves would certify their drivers, and then the company would be listed on the central database. Independent drivers would have to go through that same process, going to a city office and being certified.
But for a driver who is going through Uber, they aren't necessarily being asked to register in this database.
They would be registered as an Uber employee, but Uber would keep their information, and just the company would be on the database. So if we needed to find an Uber driver, we would look in the database, find Uber, and call them up, and they would have their whole list of drivers.
Right, just to be clear,
we didn't want to share, you know, I don't think a lot of companies want to share their driver information on the database, so they would be listed as a company.
Nor would a lot of people who drive for those companies necessarily want to have the city having all of its information either. The companies, though, Uber and Lyft, have been having issues all around the country, particularly with Uber, and looking at what they've talked about in response to this bill, do you think this is going to be enough to push them over the edge to leave?
We've been working with them on what should go into the database, and they're comfortable with having them listed just as a company. And so Charlie's, the cab, they would all be listed as a company, but they are responsible. It's like a third-party permitting thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the company would be responsible and liable for the information of their drivers, so that if the police or the city or anyone needs information, the city would call Uber or Lyft and get that information. Because, as I say, the bottom line is the protection and safety of the customer.
At this point, with all the bills that we've talked about having passed second reading, now coming to the Budget Committee today, do you expect that this is just going to continue along?
We're hoping to bring it to a close soon. We were hoping to end this today, but not sure, because we're still refining what certification includes. I don't think it would be medical, and a criminal background check for 7 years is what Uber does. The city only does two years, so we're going to do 7 years criminal background check nationally. We're going to follow whatever national and federal laws there are regarding these drivers.
All right. Well, we'll see, in fact, if this moves along as you anticipate that it might.
Mm-hmm. hoping that it will, but I kind of don't see that happening because we're not that close to refining all the certification standards and how the vehicles and whether every vehicle has to have a decal on its bumper, noting that they went through a safety check, which is done by the company. All of this information will be done by the company.
So if you expect that this is going to go on for a little while longer?
Maybe we may defer to the next month's budget committee, but then it would be deferred to the next month's council meeting also.
Which means we'll be watching and seeing how this journey plays out. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're hoping that we can get this done and have our passengers protected.
And Kobayashi, thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The Honolulu City Council Committee on Budget Agenda will cover Bill 34, that's the use of public school lands, Bill 35, real property tax credits for low-income homeowners, and Bill 36, the private transportation services and driver's bill we were just talking about, meeting today at 9 o'clock at Councilman Ann Kobayashi is the Budget Committee Chair.
Aloha, I'm Chief Warrant Officer Michael J. Smith from the Marine Forces Pacific Band. You're tuned to HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about a man who became Lieutenant Governor of Hawaii for a single term from 1974 to 1978. He first ascended to the position when then-Governor Burns became ill and George Ariyoshi became acting governor. When that happened, he and Ariyoshi became the first ever Japanese Americans to hold simultaneously the governor and lieutenant governor posts of any state in the U.S. He ran unsuccessfully for mayor of Honolulu against Frank Fossey in 1978, spent the rest of his career as a justice in the Marshall Islands and as a teacher in Japan. He came home to Waimea on Hawaii Island, where he helped build the North Hawaii Community Hospital. He died in 2015 at the age of 93, and this morning we asked you for his name, which was Nelson Kiyoshi Doi, the fifth lieutenant governor of the state of Hawaii.
And Sean Goodspeed called us from Ala Moana. Knew the answer. Actually, this was a very, very popular quiz. The phone lines were lighting up.
Good.
So if you knew the answer too, well, good for you. Meanwhile, Sean's going to get the T-shirt, and you can try again tomorrow. It's now 8:47, and if you've got a quiz for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
There's something about coming home, returning to familiar surroundings and familiar company. It's a time to rediscover the things you love best and think about the ways you've changed since you last came home. Homecoming is the theme of a new Adaptations dance theater concert that brings featured dancers with Maui ties back to a place that has inspired them. Amelia Couture is the executive director of the Adaptations Dance Theater and the choreographer of a world premiere event at the concert. She's on the line from her studio. Good morning, Amelia.
Good morning, Chris.
What gave you the idea for this, the theme of this concert?
Well, Hallie Hunt, the artistic director of Adaptations Dance Theater, and myself, and Nicole Humphrey, another director of the company, were talking last year about all the wonderful dancers we knew personally who were currently dancing in major companies in mainland America.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, how wonderful it would be to be able to hire some of these dancers to come and do a concert with us here, because it's a little unfair that Maui doesn't get to see these dancers, that Maui raised them and sent them off into the world, and we don't get to benefit from them. So we thought that we wanted to try to fix that.
Bring the prodigals home, yeah?
Exactly.
Well, as you and it seems to have had an effect on each of the dancers. Just the whole idea of coming home has an effect on them, doesn't it?
I think that all of these dancers are really excited to be able to share what they do every day and what they have huge passion for and have dedicated their whole lives to with their own families, with their own friends, with the teachers here on the island who taught them and nurtured them to become the dancers they are today. So, yeah, it's a very emotional and important moment for all of the dancers in the show.
How do you weave that sort of bring it home theme into the actual performances, Amelia?
Well, the bring it home theme is not so much a part of the choreography of the show, mm-hmm. but is just in the dancers who we're bringing home. The theme of the show actually is the new piece we're presenting is sort of a science experiment, if you will.
Uh-huh.
We're sort of weaving elements of science and math into the choreography, and the dancers are bringing it home just by being here, really.
Well, tell me more about the science and math angle, because that's that's an unusual avenue, isn't it?
It is, but I created this system of choreography that I call Couture, Adaptive Dance Method, or CADM for short, that codifies dance into numeric phrases and then can also take numbers and turn those numbers into dance. So we took certain really famous numbers that are important in the world of science and math, like the number pi and uh-huh. the number phi, and also the idea of rolling dice to create random numeric chains of numbers, and then translated those numbers using the CADM system into movement.
Using the what system?
CADM, which is CADM, which stands for Couture Adaptive Dance Method.
Okay. So at some point, each number generates a specific movement, is that right?
Yeah. So it's a specific and a general movement. So take example, the number 15 in the system stands for bending of the spine. So a dancer could do that in any number of ways, but still have the root movement coming from bending the spine. So a lot of the dance is absolutely choreographed, and then a certain amount of it is also improvisational, and the dancers can interpret the numbers as they would like in their bodies.
Which means they have to have a pretty good command of this particular number system, doesn't it?
Yeah, and so since we had a really short rehearsal period with this group of dancers, we've practiced and rehearsed the numbers so that they feel comfortable with them.
Mm-hmm. So in this particular number, you're not generating the random movements then. You are calling for specific movements at specific times, yeah?
For most of it, yeah. And then we workshopped certain phrases in the studio so the dancers knew they were responsible for a certain phrase of numbers, and then they could sort of practice that and create a phrase that suits them that they could memorize but then take a lot of artistic license within it as well. But the majority of the phrase is choreographed using the number system.
It sounds as if it calls for a little bit of that sort of jazz musician's state of consciousness where you're kind of ready to go right or left in the moment, yeah?
Yeah, and Chris, it's interesting you say that because jazz music was the inspiration for this system. I wanted to create a way for dancers to improvise similar to the way that jazz musicians can improvise.
Mm-hmm. Which is, by the way, based on numbers in a large degree, right?
Exactly, yeah. You have your 3, 4, 5, you know, your chords. Like my husband, Toby Couture, is a jazz musician and composer. He actually composed the music for most of the entire concert is his original composition. And so, yeah, he was a big inspiration to me for that, for creating this system.
Yeah, I can see the link because, as he will tell you, you know, musicians will sort of signal 4 and 5 to each other, go to the 4 chord, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
And that's very similar, isn't it?
Exactly. And I was trying to, the same way musicians have their notes and their keys and time signatures. You know, I wanted to create a similar way for dancers to communicate the same way. So we also can use the musical notes and the rhythmic notations, you know, quarter notes, half notes, eighth notes, sixteenths, and then these numbers instead of tones and notes. We have these numbers which sort of represent the notes of the body, if you will.
Well, you know, Amelia, I've always wondered about that with choreography, is how do you codify it, right? How do you notate a piece from a long-gone choreographer like an Ashton or a Balanchine? You know, how do you write that down? You can't completely do it, can you?
It's mostly passed down through generations of dancers. There is a way that is a very, very old way of writing ballet choreography, uh-huh. but it's not really taught or used anymore. There's only a few people in the world who can actually translate it and use it. But mostly it's through a system of apprenticeship, you know, with a great choreographer, and they pass it down to their disciples who then pass it to the next generation, like a oral language, but this being a movement language.
And it probably needs to be kept that way as much as possible, wouldn't you think?
I think that it's going to change and evolve inevitably with each generation, you know, the same way an oral story might. That's why it's so important to people like Balanchine.
Yeah.
You have to be one of the very few people who are allowed to pass down Balanchine choreography because they're trying to keep the integrity of the choreography.
Yeah.
But over a certain number of generations, that it's very hard to keep your own personal style out of how you do, and things will inevitably change as they're passed down.
I would think so, yeah. Amelia, I wish you luck with this upcoming concert, and thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, can I just quickly tell people where it is?
I'll tell them.
All right, great. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Amelia. Amelia Couture is the executive director of the Adaptations Dance Theater, whose first annual Bring It Home concert is this weekend at the Seabury Hall, A'ali'i Kuhonua Creative Arts Center in Makawao. You can find out more on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
For the first time, Kuana Torres Kahele and various hula halau will be performing the new music he has created for the Hawaiian Islands across two back-to-back concerts. This year's HPR Palikū Theater event on August 7th gives you the choice of an afternoon or an evening performance, or choose both and enjoy a mini luau between shows. Please go to events on hawaiipublicradio.org for more. Kuana Torres Kahele, August 7th at the Palikū Theater.
Ever since ride-sharing and the new generation of car services came along, there have been questions about accountability, consistency across the board, yeah?
And there have also been some incidents which have made the news and made people, you know, think twice about having the sharing economy affect their lives in that way.
Yeah.
And obviously there are bad actors all around. But what it means for this one particular bill and having everybody being registered if they're a transportation company, and have them registered under the company, not necessarily viewable to the city. That's an interesting concept. We'll see what happens with that one. That is going to do it for us for this Wednesday. Now, tomorrow, you know that, first of all, you know that we talk a lot about the needs of homeless people. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about looking for landlords and what that really means and some efforts underway right now. Kimo Carvalho from IHS will join us.
And we'll have cinema with a French accent at the Honolulu Museum of Art. Let us hear from you on our talkback line, which is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
One of these days we'll have to get you to do that in a French accent. If you missed any part of this show, you want more, go to hawaiipublicradio.org. Just look for The Conversation under Talk Shows.
I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.